Welcome to Crime Wire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. I am Kim Colton, your host. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. Or you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. My special guest tonight is author Steve Hodell. Steve is here tonight to talk about one of the country's most spellbinding unsolved homicides, the murder of Elizabeth Short, known as the Black Dahlia. Steve is a prestigious former LAPD detective turned private investigator. He made some surprising discoveries as he was sifting through his deceased father's belongings after his death in 1999. In the belongings of Dr. George Hodell were pictures of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, when she was alive. Immersing himself in an investigation of the evidence found, as well as interviewing other investigators, Steve Hodell realized that the Black Dahlia murder was most likely not the first, nor the last, committed by the number one suspect, Dr. George Hodell, his father, described as possibly responsible for 7 to 20 serial murders around Los Angeles. Welcome, Steve, to the show.
Thanks, Kim. Thank you so much for being with you.
It is just wonderful to have you here. Now, you have written 3 books on this subject. The first one is The Black Dahlia Avenger, A Genius for Murder. That was released in 2003, and then you did an updated release, which contained previously unreleased documents, forensic evidence, and photographs.
Right.
And your second book, titled Most Evil, Avenger, Zodiac, and the Further Serial Murders of Dr. George Hill Hodell. And this book compiles even further evidence of possible murders and crimes committed by Dr. Hodell. And then your third book, Black Dahlia 2, Avenger 2, presenting the follow-up investigation and further evidence linking Dr. George Hodell to Los Angeles's Black Dahlia and other 1940s lone woman murders. Very interesting. Well, let's start out with your background in police work. You have quite the extensive background.
Okay. Yeah. I'm old school. Came on the job 4 years Navy, 17 to 21. Then I came on LAPD in 1963, and spent the next 24 years. Working for LAPD, basically 5 years in uniform patrol, and then I went to detectives and to Hollywood, worked all the different tables, robbery, child abuse, sex crimes, and ultimately wound up on the homicide table in Hollywood, where I basically stayed for the next 18 years until I retired. 300 murder investigations, had one of the highest clearance rates, solve rates on the department, about it ran between 75-80% of my crimes. So basically I'm pretty much just with homicide and honorably retired after 24 years, became a PI, and you know, what else do you do after you've done investigations? Basically moved out of the area in 86 when I retired. I had 2 small boys, moved up to beautiful Bellingham, Washington, which is like the last stop before you hit Canada, and became a PI up there and was living up there, and my boys were going through school up there, and I was doing criminal investigations, and basically that was it, living a nice, fairly quiet, retired life until my father came along, and basically he had been gone. He'd been in Asia for about 38 years, and decided to come home and return to the United States. So he came back in 1990, and we hooked up and became very close for the next decade. He lived another 9 years and retired, basically had a heart attack in 99. And I get a phone call at 3 in the morning from his wife and said, "Steve, your father's collapsed. The paramedics are here. You need to come down right away." So I jumped a plane, flew down, did all the things that you do to take care of a parent's passing. And while we're sitting there a day or two after his death, she's totally traumatized. She was 40 years his junior, and they'd been married 30 years. And she gave me she gave me an album, a small photo album of his with a bunch of photos in it. And I was going through it, and there were these beautiful photographs of my mother and my brothers and I and family stuff. And there was a photo of a nude woman, reclining nude woman. And I said, "June, who's this?" And she looked at it, and she said, "I don't know, somebody your father knew from a long time ago." And the face looked familiar. It was clearly taken like in the 40s with the flower in the hair, that sort of thing. And basically, Black Dahlia comes to mind. Now, I don't, I had never worked the case. You know, that was an old case. I was 60s, 70s, and that was in the 40s. But it was our one of our most famous unsolves from LAPD. And I had seen a film called Who is the Black Dahlia that came out in the 70s. And it looked just like her. You know, the flower and all of this stuff. And I'm not quite sure this day why it came to mind. But at any rate, I started looking at that crime, and which I knew very little about, didn't even know the victim's name, Elizabeth Short, and started looking at it. And three or four things came together quickly that were kind of like blinking red lights. The first was that a surgeon did the crime. They were absolutely positive about this, a skilled surgeon. Well, of course, Dad was a skilled surgeon. The next blinking red light was basically my girlfriend was living in L.A., and she was sending me up information on the crime from the newspapers. And on the front page of the newspaper from 1947, there was a note. The killer had been sending in notes taunting the police about the murder. And basically, the note read, "Turning myself in on Wednesday, had my fun at the police, signed Black Dahlia of Edgar." And I looked at it, and I looked at the handwriting, and it was my father's handwriting. I mean, you know your parents' handwriting. Your
listeners
know
their
parents' handwriting. And I thought, no, this can't be. There's some other reason for this. But basically, So those blinking red lights. And I talked to my half sister Tamar, who I hadn't spoken to in 50 years, and we were talking about my father's, you know, our father's passing. And she said, "Well, you know, he was a suspect in the Dahlia case." And I says, "What are you talking about, Tamar?" She says, "Yeah, he was, but she says he didn't do it, but he was a suspect." Well, with that, and I said, "I need to go back to relocate to L.A. and sit, you know, take a look at all of this figure this out," fully believing I would be able to clear my father. He had nothing to do with it. I was convinced he was not involved at all. There was some other explanation. So I would spend the next 3 years putting it all together and then basically going in secret and submitting it to the district attorney of Los Angeles. But maybe before we get ahead of ourselves, maybe we could either talk about what, you know, maybe your listeners, you know, some details on the crime itself, about what happened
Yes.
You want to do that?
We can't. Yes, I do, because we can't assume that everybody remembers this or is in the loop on it. So, yes, please.
Okay.
We'll talk about Elizabeth Short.
Yeah, what happened? So it's a cold winter morning, January 15th, 1947, in Los Angeles. Basically, a woman is taking her young daughter in a stroller to market early in the morning, about 9 in the morning, and she's walking down an area called Leimert Park, which is about 5 miles south of Hollywood, California, and she looks over in this large vacant lot, and she sees what she thinks is a mannequin, and she looks over, and she thinks, "Oh, dear, that's going to scare the kids when they're going to school. They're going to think it's a person or something." So she door knocks. She keeps going south, and she door knocks at a house, calls the police and says there's a mannequin in the lot here, and it's pretty scary looking, and you might want to have somebody come out and take it away because the kids pass by here to go to school. So a black and white responds, gets to the crime scene, and they're horrified. It's not a mannequin. It's, in fact, a human being, a woman, totally nude. Body is perfectly surgically bisected at the waist, cut in half. And the upper portion and the lower portion are juxtaposed just inches from the sidewalk, carefully posed in a very unique position. The body is completely washed clean. There are cutting signs of torture. Detectives respond, start investigating, and they're horrified at what they see. I'm not going to go into all the details because it's really one of the reasons why this crime became one of LA's most horrific and most infamous crimes was because of what was done to Elizabeth Short. And basically, there was, you know, they estimate about 4 hours of torture, cuttings to the body, all sorts of things done, pieces cut out of flesh cut out and inserted elsewhere, and it was just absolutely horror. And these veteran
and
homicide cops, you know, saw this, and so that started the case. And of course, the press were all there taking their photographs, many of them kind of trampling through the crime scene and stuff, and. And they started, and she was a Jane Doe. There was no ID, no hers, no nothing, just the nude body. And clearly a young woman, about 22, 20-ish or something. And so they get her fingerprints, they send them to the FBI, and they get a name, Elizabeth Short, 22 years old, from Medford, Massachusetts. And they start doing the background check on her, and basically she was not, it wasn't an unusual story. A beautiful, young, dark-haired, black-haired woman comes out to L.A. to maybe be discovered.
Find fame and fortune.
Yeah, she came out, initially came out in 43, a few years earlier, and so it was wartime. World War II was in full bore, and she basically was, you know, she wanted to fall in love, meet Lieutenant Wright, and live happily ever after, you know. And she hung out at a lot of the USO places and stuff. And she got a job at Camp Cook, which was about 40 miles north of L.A. And she was working there for a while in the PX, in the military store. And very attractive, full black hair. And then the reporters actually started, you know, doing their own thing and their own investigation. And she was hanging out at a soda fountain in Long Beach, which is 20 miles south of there, and the guys in there called her the Black Dahlia. That's where the name came from. There was a movie out that summer called The Blue Dahlia with Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake. And so it was a murder mystery, a noir film, and so they kind of did a spinoff on that, and they called her the Black Dahlia. She would come in there and have her, she wasn't much of a drinker, but she would have her Cokes or sodas and stuff, and very attractive. And so you've got this, you know, this name, the Black Dahlia, and this horrific crime. And, of course, it went headlines for 30, 40 days straight above the fold, you know. And it was just this everybody, we had six large newspapers there, everybody each vying to be, you know, to get the scoop on the story. And hundreds and hundreds of police officers were assigned to the case, and basically, they weren't able to come up with much information other than who she was and that she'd been, you know, going out on dates with guys and stuff, but not a lot of background information. So then it kind of went quiet for a while, and then the killer actually starts writing in letters, notes to his friends. He sends in a total of a dozen in the next few weeks. And catch me if you can, you know, I'll turn myself in for $10,000, you know, and a whole bunch of, some of them were cut and paste, you know, like a ransom note. Others were, handwriting was disguised. But this one note, which I've mentioned earlier, was, you know, said turning myself in on January 29th, had my fun at the police, and he signed it the Black Dahlia Avenger. And I suspect that the killer was going to turn himself in because it wasn't, like, unlike all the others, it wasn't disguised handwriting. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, but he didn't. He must have had a change of heart and figured, well, heck, let him catch me, but, you know, to hell, heck with this.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't. And then it kind of went quiet and submerged beneath the surface after the publicity died down and would come back up every 5 or 10 years on the anniversary of the date. You know, one of the newspapers would start talking about the Black Dahlia. And then from there it became spun off into myth and lots of stories and a lot of untruths and misinformation built up.
Right.
And, you know, hack writers jumped on the story and it became quite famous on its own, but a lot of misinformation. So that was a lot of misinformation. Yeah, so that's kind of where we were on the crime itself. And then, go ahead. Did you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to say I've seen the crime scene pics, and I'm just one of the other shocking point of it is how close she was to the sidewalk, to a public sidewalk.
Right.
That, I mean, she was not hidden at all. She was just out there splayed out for everybody who walked by to see whether, and you got to remember the time, late 1940s, you have mothers and children walking and with their strollers and that, and it's just, it really says a lot about the killer, in my opinion.
Absolutely, because he definitely wanted her body found. It wasn't like he was trying to hide anything. And he was, I mean, that was part of his...
In a shocking way, he wanted it found.
Right, that's right. And his ultimate goal, and I would discover once I got into a heavy-duty investigation into some of the other links, I found, you know, his whole intent was to he was an urban terrorist. He wanted to horrify and hold a city. You know, that's why the writings, that's why the tauntings and the letters. He wanted to stay on page one. He wanted the publicity.
Right.
He wanted to terrify. And L.A. was terrified. I mean, women and children and everybody was afraid to go out for months and months, you know, because and then what happened was so basically, maybe we should jump to, you know, to really understand this story, you kind of need to understand who my father was, what a remarkable individual in many ways he was. And so if you
extremely
want me to take...
Extremely intelligent.
In Black Dahlia Avenger, my first book, I go into, the first third is heavy biographics on Dad because, it's so important to understand him as an individual. To understand the crimes. So if you want, I can take a few minutes and lay that out.
Oh, please do. I agree with you. It's very important.
Yeah. So George Hodel is born in 1907 in Los Angeles. my grandparents, his mother and father, Russian Jews from Kiev and Odessa. They came here at through Ellis Island, basically at the turn of the century in 1903, to New York, then came out west to L.A. Dad's born in 1907. At the age of 7 or 8, he's identified as a child prodigy, a musical prodigy, piano. He's playing his own concerts at the Shrine Auditorium at the age of 9, highly gifted. His teacher, his music teacher, predicts a tremendous future for him as a composer and pianist. He starts attending in Pasadena, which is a community just outside of L.A. He's going to high school. He's scoring off the charts. Not only is he musically gifted, he's intellectually gifted. IQ of 186, 1 point above Einstein. That skips a generation, by the way. And off the charts, and he enrolls, he graduates at 13 from high school. He enrolls at Caltech, which is a premier prestigious university here in Pasadena. Enrolls at Caltech at the age of 14 and starts attending there. He's there a year, and he has, not only is he intellectually gifted, he's also sexually precocious, and he starts having an affair with a professor's wife, and she gets pregnant. He's asked to leave. Obviously, she destroys her life, breaks up her marriage. She goes back east to have the child. George, at 15 now, follows her back east, says, I want to marry you and be the father of the child. This woman, this professor, says, George, you've ruined my life. You're a child yourself. Get out of my life. Go away, you know, and just laughs at it. So he comes back to L.A., passes himself. Now he's like 16, 17, and he passes himself off as 21 and basically gets a job as a journalist, crime reporter, for one of the large local newspapers, the L.A. Record. And so we're now into like 1926. He's writing, this is Prohibition. He's riding around with the Vice Squad, LAPD Vice guys, they're kicking doors, and he's writing these kind of tabloid articles in the newspaper. The judge is found with a young blonde in the bar, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then he graduates and starts riding around with the homicide guys in LAPD and writing these tabloid murder stories, the Black Ace of Spades next to the body and that sort of thing. Gets into drugs, Chinatown. You know, he's basically smoking and very edgy stuff. He opens his own magazine called Fantasia Magazine, which he's editor of, and it's very edgy, and he's producing that. And then he starts double dating with another man, John Huston, who many of your listeners may know will eventually become the famous film director, you know, Maltese Falcon and a lot of noir and African Queen, all sorts of amazing films.
All kinds of amazing films.
Yeah, but back then he was just the son of Walter Huston, who was a very famous actor of that day.
Also amazing, right.
Yeah. So John Huston and George are good, close friends, and they start double dating these two women, Dorothy and Emilia, and they're all in their late teens now. And basically after a few months, George is dating Dorothy and John is dating Emilia, but then they switch and John falls in love with Dorothy. They run off to New York, Greenwich Village, get married, and become part of that whole community. And Emilia and George are looking at each other and saying, I guess it's you and me, babe. And she quickly gets pregnant by George, and they go north now to San Francisco, and George decides to go to Berkeley and become a doctor. He wants to be a medical doctor. So he goes to pre-med at Berkeley for 4 years. Then he goes across the bay to San Francisco for another 4 years for his MD. He writes for the San Francisco Chronicle as a journalist while he's going through medical school, has another affair with another woman, and she gets pregnant, and a daughter is born to him by the name of Tamar in 35. He had the boy Duncan in 28. So so now he's got the girl child back east whose name was Folly, the woman named her Folly, and he's got Duncan, and now he's got Tamar, and he's just graduating from medical school. Among his other many gifts, he's got natural eye-hand coordination. His professors in medical school are vying for him to be their assistant in their surgeries because he's such a naturally skilled surgeon. So he graduates in 36 and decides to take off and get away from all of this, and he becomes a doctor at a logging camp, a surgeon at a logging camp. Mm. In 36, goes to Arizona, doctors to the Hopi and Navajo reservations for a year or so, and then goes back to L.A. and basically joins the L.A. County Health Department, specializing in venereal disease control, VD control. Quickly rises to the top, becomes the head VD control officer for all of L.A. County. This is like 7 years later now. Dorothy, who was with John for 7 years, breaks up. Their marriage breaks up. She comes back, hooks back up with George. They get married. And my older brother, Michael, is born in 39. I come along in 41. My younger brother, Kelvin, comes along in 42. So here's George. He's now head of L.A. County Health Department, VD. Beautiful wife, three sons in L.A. now. And basically he buys a Frank Lloyd Wright Jr. home, basically a Mayan temple in Hollywood. It's, looks like it's right off a set from you know, the movies. Mm-hmm. And we all move in into this incredible home, you know, incredible home in Hollywood. And everything's going along fine for a couple of years. We're in the mid-40s now, all sorts of movie people, interesting people, artists and writers, and everybody are coming to the house and visiting Dad. He's, you know, definitely with the rich and famous types, and he's a, becomes a mover and shaker in Los Angeles, part of the power structure. And at that point, in 1949, there's a knock at the door, and it's LAPD. And they say, Dr. Hodel, and he says, yes. And they say, you're under arrest for incest, for child molestation. Mm-hmm. Well, remember Tamar, the daughter that was born in 35? She's now 14. She's now 14 and was living with us for the summer. And she ran away, picked up by the police, and she discloses that, you know, they said, why, you know, why did you run away? And she says, because my life is so terrible. And they said, what are you talking about? So she discloses that Dad had intercourse with her at 14, you know. And big headlines, Dad's arrested. He gets Jerry Geisler, who was kind of the Johnny Cochran of that day, top criminal defense attorney, who represented all the stars, and mostly on sex cases. And it was kind of an O.J. trial, three-week trial, big headlines, and in about 45 minutes, an hour, they come back with a not guilty. Now, this is even with three adults present in the room who testified to witnessing the acts. You know, I mean, it's like, how do you beat a case like that? Anyway, he beat
right.
it. Jury comes back not guilty. And he quickly, shortly after that, in 1950, he leaves L.A. and goes abroad to Asia. I don't want to take up too much time, otherwise we'll never get to some of the other stuff. But basically, he's there 40 years, reinvents himself as a market researcher, remarries a wealthy Filipina, has four more children, divorces her after 4 years. So in 1990, when he decides to come back after 35 years absent, he comes back to San Francisco, to downtown and the 39th floor penthouse. He now has 11 children by five different women, and he's divorced, and now he has June, who's, like I say, 40 years his younger, and they're living there, and I become very close with Dad in 1990, and we see each other for the next 10 years, and he comes up to visit me, I go down to visit him, and then he dies. So you can see that this is an individual who was, you know, I mean, he had this, he was, not only was he very handsome, but he had this charisma and power where we were all kind of in awe of the man. He was this incredible. He could have done anything, you know. So
I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah. So basically, that's the background. Now you can see that this man basically could have done anything. He could have cured cancer. He had so much potential.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll jump back to, okay. So I begin my investigation after his death, and with these few blinking red lights that I'm cautious about, I go down to L.A., I start investigating, I contact as many witnesses as possible from the old days, and one thing leads to another. I have the handwriting analyzed independent and do a blind analysis. I mean, I know it's Dad's handwriting, but that's still the son saying it, so I got an expert witness to, handwriting expert comes back with it. And I put it all together, a lot of witnesses' statements, and I go in secret, and I present the case to a guy named Steve Kay, who's an active head deputy DA with L.A. County. He's like third from the top. And he reviews it for 6 months, says, you know, comes back and says, based on your findings and based on the photographic evidence and everything else you've come up with, the other startling thing was, as I'm investigating the case, I mean, it's as if it's not horrific enough to link into the Black Dahlia murder, I discover that actually he was a serial killer, and there were other other murders before and after in L.A. that he was connected to. And one of these was a woman by the name of Jean French, 3 weeks after the Dahlia murder. Nude body placed on a vacant lot about 5 miles west of the other crime scene. Lipstick, he took lipstick and wrote an obscenity on the body and signed it BD for Black Dahlia. So they knew that was, LAPD knew that was connected. Clearly it was connected for a whole bunch of reasons. Her body wasn't cut in half, but because of all the other stuff, handwriting was very distinctive. So, and basically we don't have time to discuss, but there was about five or six other murders in the area that he also committed. So I submit the seven or eight murders to the head DA, and he comes back and says, you know, a lot of smoke and fire here, Steve, but he said, you know, basically I have a very strict filing policy. And he said, I would file two counts of murder against your father, the Black Dahlia and the Jean French red lipstick murder. He says the other five are probably he's good for, but he said it's, there's not enough there. So basically with that, once I got that opinion, and I knew he was, you know, I knew I would get it because, you know, that being a detective,
right,
you know if you've made your case or not, and I knew it was, you
right,
know, the evidence was strong. So basically,
and
then
Steve,
I went public with it.
Okay. Well, Steve, let me just back you up just a bit.
Sure.
I just can't imagine how you came to grips with everything. I mean, you initially started out saying, oh, impossible. I'm going to prove that this is incorrect. And
right,
when did you actually realize, and how did you come to grips with this information,
right,
when you finally thought, OMG, this is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was, you know, it kept building. I mean, it was, you know, what I thought was I would follow the evidence and the evidence would show that he had nothing to do with it. I'd be able to clear him and prove him wrong. Well, of course, and then you've got two things happening here. You've got the trained professional homicide detective, veteran homicide detective, who's skilled in what he does, and you've got the son of the suspect. You know, so I knew I had to keep these separate. You know, I couldn't, otherwise I'd contaminate the investigation
and
you know, but in a sense, you have to do that in in every case you do. I mean, I get a call out at 3 in the morning, and it's a father is in custody, and he's beaten his 6-year-old son to death, you know. And you have to walk
right
in there, give him a cup of coffee, a cigarette, whatever, be objective,
right,
and get your cop out, get your admission or whatever,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to do that in every
yeah
case.
But, right, and your professionalism came out, and you knew what to do.
Well, I was I was wired to, you know, to do that.
You're wired
time,
to do it, yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, you can't, when it's your, I've never had a case quite like this where, you know.
Oh,
and,
I guess
and,
not.
And there were a lot of things I didn't know about my father. I mean, we've talked about the biographics, and a lot of that I discovered
yeah
as I was invested. So it was a parallel, parallel investigation into my father's secret dark past, because I didn't know a lot of those things that I've related until I got into the investigation. And then the crime investigation, two separate paths. So, but, you know, basically, you know, I think I've been through every possible emotion that you can think of. I mean, anger,
oh, yeah,
you know, and now after 10 years, 12 years of review and three books, basically I'm just at a point of terrible sadness, you know, it's just a terrible sadness. Because of
mm-hmm
the potential, and I mean, I love my father. You know, to this day, I love
right
him. I mean, there's his blood
right
flowing through my, you know, my blood is his blood, and that part,
right,
you know. So I'm kind of like Elizabeth Short was surgically bisected. I'm psychologically, emotionally bisected by, you know, the fact that there are these two. There's the father I love, and there's this monster inside of him, and
right
basically, that I see him as very much as a Jekyll and Hyde. Okay. There was Dr. Jekyll, the good Dr. Jekyll, who did do good things in life. You know, I'm sure he, you know, during the war he was in China and he, you know, saved a lot of lives as a doctor, and
mm-hmm
you know, basically. But then there was the monster, the stronger part, sadly, that was the serial killer and just kept on going. And you know, and I was I'm not real big on the psychological aspects because I'm kind of more science and I'm a more objective. But you can't deny that. This definitely was a split personality here, or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And how, I have to ask you, how did he feel, or how did he relate to you when he found out that first you're a police officer, you become a detective, and
right.
in the L.A. area?
Because
of his background with riding around with the police and as when he was a reporter,
right.
I mean, he must have been proud of you.
Well, he was. He expressed concern for, you know, the dangers of the job, and he clearly there was some pride. But there was another part of him that must he have thought, you know, what does Steve know?
Oh, yeah.
Has he found out anything? Because update this a little bit. So I mean, there are a lot of naysayers out there that early on said, "Oh, this is a Daddy Dearest. There's nothing to it. The photographs probably aren't her. The whole thing falls apart." So what happened was once I got the green light from the DA, head DA saying cases, at least these two are solved. Then basically I went public with it. And that created a lot of publicity back in 03 and 04. There was, you know, a Dateline, 48 Hours did a full hour on it, lots and lots of press and publicity on the case. Mm-hmm. And what that did was it forced open the DA's secret files. Steve Hodell can talk for 10 hours about how all the evidence comes together, but it's still Steve Hodell saying it. So what happened was... the DA released some secret files that had been locked away for 55 years, and they were the Hodell Black Dahlia files. And what we discovered was that George Hodell was the prime suspect all along. That LAPD
wow.
and the DA's office bugged, picked him up in 1950, and brought him into the Hall of Justice and. Ostensibly to question him, and while he was there, the cops went out and they burgled our Frank Lloyd Wright mansion, and they hid microphones, live microphones in the walls, not phone bugs, but actual microphones in the walls, and they ran a hard line through the basement. They ran it to LAPD's Hollywood Station, to the basement there, and they monitored and listened in to live conversations for the next 40 days. 18 detectives, 24/7 around the clock in shifts,
wow.
and they recorded, and they got some very damning statements from Dad to some of his confidants. Some of the statements he made were, he's talking to a German accomplice of his, and says, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they can't prove it now, they can't talk to my secretary because she's dead. Well, LAPD investigated Dad for the suspected murder of his secretary 2 years before the Dahlia murder in 1945 and couldn't put it together, couldn't prove it. So, and then he goes on to say things like, this is the best payoff between law enforcement. I've never seen such good payoffs, you know, don't cop out ever. 2 and 2 is not 4. And he admits to performing abortions at his clinic. He owned a clinic downtown. And all sorts of things that basically, were cop-outs. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm reading these transcripts, and I can't believe it. And it's,
wow.
And the most dramatic of all, and this is, you know, people, you know, your listeners will say, well, why didn't they arrest him? You know, why didn't,
mm-hmm.
well, there was, I go into three different chapters to explain what I call a Dahlia Gate, which was, basically a cover-up of the facts. And you kind of have to understand the period and the time and what was going on in the history of L.A. to really understand the cover-up. And you know, L.A. back then was a real-life L.A. Confidential. I mean, there was a lot of corruption. Half the cops on the department were on the take. Payoffs, all sorts of things were going on. And basically what happened was, I'm reading these transcripts, and on the third day of the stakeout, they're listening in, and I'm reading these transcripts, and I can't believe what they say. Basically, there's a murder that occurs on tape. I mean, it's like, how can this be? So the two detectives are listening in, and they hear a woman crying. And this is all from their transcript. A woman's crying. She tries to call the operator. Sounds very drugged or intoxicated or drugged. I think she was drugged. And she's crying, and she drops the phone, and then everything goes silent. And then we hear Dad talking to her about, does your husband know you're here? Don't worry about it. Have another drink. He'll never find out. And then some time goes by, and then I'm reading the transcript, and it says that the Baron, the German Baron, this accomplice of his, and he go down. It says they're walking downstairs to the basement, and it says a pipe is hit against an object. A woman screams. A pipe is hit again. A woman screams again, and then it goes silent. And I'm sitting there, I'm saying, what the hell's going on? Why aren't these guys, they're 4 minutes away. Why aren't they out the door,
right,
over there, kicking in the door and making a rescue?
But they, right,
they did nothing. And you can say, well, why didn't they? Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation as to why they didn't. Maybe they thought, well, maybe there's some kind of kinky sex going on. Maybe, you know, if we go now, we'll blow the stake out, and, you know, knows what.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter. The bottom line is they did nothing. And
right.
So, you know, basically, you've got LAPD. Now, at the same time this is happening, Chief Bill Parker, William Parker, is about to become the new chief of police, at the very, literally a weeks away from assuming command. And Parker was a reformer, and he was our greatest chief, and he basically wanted to turn around and get rid of the corruption. And so basically, Dad takes off and he's gone. He's in the wind. So he's left the country just about as he's about to be arrested at the end of the stakeout. They're about to arrest him, and he splits, leaves the country. So Parker is now looking at what to do. I'm about to become chief. If we disclose this, I won't get the power. I won't become chief. The scandal will, you know, stop our chances of cleaning up the department. So I think basically it was a management decision by Parker and the other powers,
right,
that be, saying, look,
yeah,
we can come back to this in the future. Let's, you know, he's in the wind. We may not be able to get him. If we do get him, he might get Jerry Geisler, and maybe we'll lose the case. And he's going to reveal a lot of things about a lot of people. He's in the know of, he's on the inside of, and we'll name names. Maybe it's better, since he's gone, just to kind of let it sit and, you know, turn things around and then clean this up. So I think kind,
right,
of like, you know, they were kind of like Machiavellian princes and made that decision to,
yeah,
for the higher
exactly,
good, you know.
Yeah,
so
for the
good smoking gun, and that, yeah, exactly. So that's the real smoking gun, and the why that it, the, you know, they didn't later arrest him, or, you know, of course the sad thing on is when you make a decision like that, you've got blood on your hands. He kills again and again.
Right, right. Once you make that kind of decision, you've closed the book. It's
yeah,
done. You can't go back. You can't open it again, because you would have, OMG.
Right.
I mean, it would just be shattering to every person.
Yeah, well, it's not unlike,
you know,
I mean, in recent news, we've had the Penn State thing. And it's not unlike,
yeah,
that, in the sense that, you know, they should have taken action earlier. They knew, you know, they knew he was molesting,
yes,
children, but,
yes,
the scandal and stuff, it's like, well, you know, maybe it's, you know, and they did. They covered,
right,
it up, and look what happened. He went on molesting. So, sadly, and then Dad would, as I got deeper and deeper into this rabbit hole of an investigation, I discovered that Dad actually committed a murder in Manila, which was his home base, which was a Black Dahlia, identical to a Black Dahlia, a woman.
I was going to ask you about that. I
yeah,
was going to ask you about that. I mean, you know, when he lived overseas there in Manila,
right,
what happened over there that they have,
yeah,
not,
well, they have,
on him?
Their most horrific, in Manila's 5-0's most horrific unsolved is a murder that occurred in the 60s called the Jigsaw Murder, and it occurred, it was a Black Dahlia, identical to the Black Dahlia. A woman was bisected, posed in a vacant lot, and this was 8 blocks from where Dad lived. They knew it was a surgical bisection. It was, I mean, it was right down the line, everything with the Black Dahlia. And, you know, they were sure it was a skilled surgeon that did it. And so that's the problem, you know, is that, and he went on to kill, you know, when you're that advanced a serial killer, you don't just quit.
Right.
You die, you go to prison, you become infirm, but you don't quit. And Dad,
right.
Dad was, you know, Dad didn't quit, sadly, and went on and on. And in my later books, I cover some of the other crimes, you know.
And that brings me to another point. You know, the serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer, everybody knows about him. And when he was looked into in his background when he was a child, because his parents were very vocal about certain things when he was
right.
a child and growing up and in his teen years, certain things were revealed. So I'm wondering, do you think there was anything earlier with George Hodel that, like, when he was 17, 18, when he, you know, I don't think it just starts at a certain age.
No.
I think.
And and that's what I'm working on now is book four, which is the early years. I don't really think, I know there were crimes earlier because it'll probably be another year, I figure year and a half, because I'm doing both the investigation, active investigation, and the writing. So book four will be the early years, and you're absolutely right.
Good.
He did start very young, much, you know, because remember, this is a 14-year-old that's got the maturity, and, or not the maturity, but the mentality and intellectual mentality of a 30-year-old. So he started quite young, and he kept, you know, he didn't wake up at age 40 in 1947 and say, I think I'll be a serial killer. And I was aware of these earlier crimes, some of them at least. But I had to start somewhere with book one, you know.
You're right.
But what we're ultimately going to have is 50 years of crime, of murder with George. I mean, it's just incredible that there were so many opportunities for him to be caught, and he just, it was almost like he was an agent for destiny, for ill, for the evil, you know. And which is one of the other observations as a son, you know, I saw Dad's, you know, idiosyncrasies. I saw his obsession with sex. I saw, you know, his inability to really not, even though he was a trained psychiatrist, he wasn't good with people. He wasn't able to relate on an emotional level with people, which is, you know,
right.
a very unusual for a psychiatrist. But anyway, but I never, so I saw all that, but I never saw the evil. I never,
right.
never, that's why I was absolutely sure that there's no way he could have done these crimes initially, because I never saw that evil, that monster inside of him. You know, I saw his other stuff, but his awkwardness, but he was a very private man. He was old school, and you know, it was like a man in an iron mask. He kept himself hidden and secret.
I wonder what your grandparents thought. I wonder what stories they could tell today, if they could.
You know, and in the end of book one, I try and look at some of the triggers as to why. I had more in book two, Most Evil. I also come up with a bunch of the triggers, but basically, you know, you've got this super intellect in the body, but you've got a child. He had an arrested development emotionally, no question about it. He probably was probably arrested at around 13 or 14, and he hated his mother. My mom used to tell stories about how much he hated his mother because, you know, he would go in and say to his mother at, say, 8 or 9, he'd say, Mom, can I go out and play baseball with the boys? And she'd say, No, Georgie, you're a pianist, not a baseball player. You'll hurt your hands. So that very controlling, she was a remarkable woman, brilliant. She was a dentist in Paris in 1900, which is unheard of.
Oh, my
gosh. A woman dentist, you know.
Yeah.
And so, very powerful, very strong. I suspect incest.
Yes.
You know, I suspect there was that he was the victim of incest, because, as you know, that's a repeat offending crime,
oh,
you know,
for sure.
Passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rejection of, remember the rejection of the professor's wife, so it laughs in his face and says, go away, George, you're a little child yourself, you know. So there's that hatred and congenital insanity. There's no question, that, you know, he had that. It was nurture and nature both combined, you know, to mm-hmm. come together in this perfect storm of, and he became an urban terrorist and just hated mankind, an only child, and just, you know, it. The monster was the stronger.
It was. It was. It's just a fascinating story. It really is. And obviously, with 8 minutes left, we're not going to get through the whole thing here. And I'm hoping, Steve, you and I have talked about this. We're going to have you back on to continue. And
yeah,
of course,
thank
you for keeping me on track somewhat tonight, but I have so many other questions I have to throw in, you know.
Well, it becomes such a narrative because there's so much to try and get in, and it's difficult to do a Q&A in the sense of there's so much to get in. I think, you know, I don't mean to be taken over, but it leaves you.
Oh, no, thank you. No, thank you for that.
Yeah, and there's basically, you know, and a lot is in the second book, which is Black Dahlia, or the third book, which is Black Dahlia Avenger 2. It basically covers the investigation from 2006 until 2012, so the last 6 years. And amazing stuff. I now have physical evidence connecting Dad from the house, items from the house found at the actual crime scene. So that was very dramatic, you know. The most recent discovery, which was really pretty cool, was I had the opportunity, thanks to the current owner of the house, to take a cadaver dog, Buster, this black lab, and it's the first time any forensic search has been done of the residence ever since 1947.
And is this of the
Franklin House, the Mayan
Franklin,
temple.
Right,
in
mansion,
the, in
okay.
The, yeah, in the basement. And he alerted to human decomposition. Now, that could be blood. I've made a strong case in book two, in the Black Dahlia Avenger 2, that the crime occurred probably in the basement. It could have occurred in the center courtyard, but more likely downstairs in the basement, where we know the other crime occurred too. If that was, you know, the later crime where the woman is screaming. Now the Buster could be alerting on that, you know, blood or bodily fluids from that crime, or the Dahlia, or both. But who knows how many, you know, women were, assaulted in that area. But bottom line is that this highly trained cadaver dog, and they only alert on human decomp. They don't alert on dead rats in the basement or anything like that. So it was very dramatic, you know. And so we're waiting. We did some soil samples recovered from the basement, and we're waiting to analyze those to see if they're consistent with human decomp. But really, what Buster's doing is corroborating the detective's findings, right, from the tape recordings. We know that a woman was assaulted and either seriously felony assault or murder in the basement. There's no question about that because we have it on tape recording. So Buster is either, you know, he's confirming their findings, and whether or not we get anything on the soil, it may come back inconclusive or it may come back to substantiate. But either way, I mean, this I have total faith in Buster's alerting, you know.
For sure.
So that was amazing, and it just goes on and on. It's like this black hole.
And we didn't even get to. Well, we touched a little bit about John Houston, but then there's Man Ray, who is.
And you could do a whole show on that. I mean, Man Ray and the whole theme and signature of the crimes. I mean, that was Dad's madness. And I go into this in detail in Most Evil, which is murder is a fine art, surrealism and all of that. That was Dad's really signature. His very unique MO and signature was was doing these crimes as murder is a fine art. And he ties it in with literature and art and films, and it's just an incredible. I mean, that's what makes this stand out above any other crime serial killer that I've been aware of. I mean, it was just, it's an amazing, it's total madness, and but it's totally unique to George O'Dell, and it was, you know, his, you know, when you get that high, that astronomical in IQ, 186, they're not wired like us mere mortals, you know, things,
oh, no,
they put
they
things
aren't.
Together in a different fashion, and that
oh,
was
completely.
What he did, yeah.
Yes,
it was
yeah.
It was actually an homage to Man Ray, his, who was a close personal friend of his and a surrealist who was at the
yes.
Franklin House many, many times.
And he photographed your mother, correct, Man Ray?
Yes. Yeah, he was our family
yeah.
photographer. Us kids
yes.
he photographed, and Dad and Mom. And they were, for 10 years, Man Ray was here from 1940 to 1950 before he returned to Paris. And Dad and he were very close, and he took quite a few photographs of the family.
So we know that they were close, but you have serious doubts that Man Ray or even John Houston had anything to do with the crimes themselves, but that they knew about them because
that's
of
right.
their
after
closeness.
The fact.
After
the fact, I have no doubt that they both knew after the fact, but were not involved in the crimes themselves. And
right.
And then another one of course, the powerful, you know, LAPD's position, official position, is the case remains unsolved, and basically they don't want to look at it. Basically, their position is we don't have time to look at Hodel's investigation. We're too busy working on current stuff. Well,
are
they,
you
know, they don't want to confirm.
I thought they said case solved.
DA said
how
that.
Could they not?
And the chief of LAPD chief of detectives said the case is solved and told them to clear it. But today's detectives basically say we haven't got time to do anything on that. And but I've also got the four original top investigators saying the case was solved and it was George O'Dell and it was, you know, we've got independent statements from the top four investigators back then. So, but you know,
right.
if they officially confirm it, then they're kind of like throwing, as they see it, mud on their two greatest heroes, Chief of Detectives Thad Brown and Chief Parker. So they kind of, it's easier for them to just say, we haven't got time to look at it.
That's such a shame. That's a crime in itself. That's a crime in itself.
It is.
Steve, we've got like a minute left, and I just want to tell our listeners that Steve Hodel will be back with Crime Wire, come hell or high water, over my dead body, he will be back.
We don't need another unsolved. Come on now.
I know, right? Right?
Yeah.
Hopefully the end of July. We've got so much to talk about, and thank you, Steve, so much for being on tonight. And I know we just touched the tip of the iceberg, really. We try to cover all the bases, but, you know, it's difficult. But I thank you so much. And just talking to you now and yesterday and stuff, just thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, and I enjoyed it thoroughly, and hopefully we'll figure out a time to do it again in the not-too-distant future.
Exactly. Thanks. I want to say thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. And Steve, you are remarkable. Thank you so much for joining me tonight, and I look forward to our continuation of this.
Okay. Investigation continued. Thanks, Kim. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. Good night, and God bless.
Same to you. Bye.
Bye.